Hello and welcome to today's Kaiser Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured web briefing, Serving the Homeless Community, New Findings on the Impact of the ACA Medicaid Expansion. Thank you all so much for joining us today. My name is Samantha Artiga with the Kaiser Family Foundation, and today we look forward to sharing the findings from a recently released report that provides analysis of how providers serving the homeless population have fared since the ACA Medicaid expansion took effect in 2014. In addition to the slides shown on today's web briefing, you can download the full report on our website at www.kss.org. The report we are sharing findings from today is based on analysis of data reported annually by health centers that we conducted with the National Healthcare for the Homeless Council. I want to start by acknowledging my co-authors on that report, Matt Warfield and Barbara DiPietro. The findings presented today provide increased understanding of how changes in coverage are affecting individuals with some of the most significant and complex healthcare needs and the providers who care for them. They also illustrate how experiences have varied between individuals and providers in the 32 states that are implementing the Medicaid expansion to low-income adults, and those in the 19 states that are not moving forward with the expansion at this time. Barbara DiPietro, who is Senior Director of Policy at the National Healthcare for the Homeless Council, will begin today's briefing by presenting the key findings from the analysis. We will then hear perspectives from leaders at Healthcare for the Homeless centers in two states, one that has implemented the Medicaid expansion and one that has not. Jackie Engel, Outreach and Enrollment Director, and Andy Patterson, Director of Homeless Services at Family Health Centers in Louisville, Kentucky, will provide insight into how the findings translate into on-the-ground experiences in an expansion state. Cindy Funkhauser, President and CEO at Sulzbacher Center in Jacksonville, Florida, will provide perspective on experiences from a non-expansion state. We will then open up the discussion for a question and answer period. I will note that today's presentation will touch on the findings at a high level, so I would encourage you to take a look at the full report for additional details and information beyond what we will be able to share today. Again, that report is available on our website at kss.org. And before we turn to the key findings, just a few housekeeping items. A recording of this webinar will be made available after the event on our website. We will hold our question and answer session after all speakers have provided their remarks, but you should feel free to submit questions as we proceed. We have a lot of folks listening in today, so we'll be unlikely to get through all the questions, but we'll do our best to get through as many as possible. Now, to get started, let's turn to Barbara DiPietro from the National Healthcare for the Homeless Council to tell us more about the key findings from the report.
Thanks, Samantha. Really appreciate being able to do this analysis, which gives us greater data to put to prior projects that we had done that were based largely on focus groups that examined how Medicaid was impacting the healthcare for the homeless community, the patients and the providers that serve them, and looking at how people were planning for the expansion and then how that implementation was going. So this gives us more data to be able to look at the disparities and learn a little bit more about this patient population and the folks that serve them. What we were really trying to do also is look specifically at coverage differences, how services are used, and particularly the financing that goes behind these nonprofit community-based health centers. So when we look at healthcare for the homeless, these are health centers that focus specifically on homeless populations. And this population generally, as Samantha had said earlier, they've got greater healthcare needs, they tend to have poorer health outcomes. And so looking at this patient group and the providers that serve them can really help illustrate where we might target some more attention to get greater improvements. The data also allowed us to make comparisons between healthcare for the homeless projects in expansion states and in non-Medicaid expansion states, as well as then combining, or rather comparing, HCH experiences with other types of health centers that serve also a low-income population but tend not to be as homeless. So again, we're just building on prior work with a data set that allows us to do a greater analysis. Next slide. When we look at the disparities, health coverage here has got such a tremendous impact on patient care, the comprehensive services that are available, and then operations at a health center. And so the differences across types of health centers and between expansion and non-expansion state projects are really important. This graph here shows a lot of the disparities. In particular, note that the healthcare for the homeless and expansion states they started at a higher level of coverage than their counterparts in non-expansion states. And so what we're seeing is that as states adopt Medicaid coverage, which we hope more will, they'll be starting from a lower threshold overall as a baseline. So that makes the outreach and enrollment efforts in those areas all the more critical. And again, just thinking about the realities in operations and patient needs based on where someone lives and then whether what type of health center they are. Next slide. When we look at the type of coverage, so this graph gives us a little bit more detail than the previous, which looked at any type of coverage. This looks at specifically what kinds of insurance generally covers either populations at other types of health centers or at HCH projects. And as you can see, there are also clearly some disparities that are predicated on whether a state has expanded Medicaid or not. You'll see that in non-expansion states, patients are still largely uninsured, and you can see that there's been a tremendous difference in the coverage in expansion states. Although when we look at other types of health centers, you see a broader range of the types of care or the types of coverage that people receive. So in an HCH environment, you'll see that Medicaid is still the primary insurer, with private insurance being very slight, and then Medicare or other public programs are really only being 6 or 8% of that. And so we've got predominantly an uninsured patient group in non-expansion states still. And one thing to note, too, is that within each of these categories, even within expansion states, we still have wide range of experience based on the state. In the issue brief, you'll see the state-by-state breakdown in terms of the percentage change year over year from 13 to 14, and you'll see a wide range of experience. Everyone is in a different place. So even within expansion states, you saw some states that had a double-digit reduction in the number of uninsured patients, but then in other states, you'll see an increase in uninsured patients. And the same was true in non-expansion states. So every state is going to be in a unique space. Next slide, please. Another piece we wanted to look at was the kinds of services that patients access at the different types of providers. And as you might imagine, the range of services that patients need in a healthcare for the homeless setting is going to be very different than other types of health centers. And this, I think, reflects the broader range of behavioral health needs that our patients need. It's also important to note, too, that healthcare for the homeless projects are required to provide substance abuse services. So that also will make a difference in what's available. But the patient need here is obviously reflected in how those services are spread. One thing I'd like to point out is the enabling services in the light blue box or in that bar. For those not from a health center environment, enabling services are those non-medical services that make the medical care work better. So that's case management, it's outreach and transportation, language translation services, health education. These are really critical services for a homeless population in particular, because that helps them engage in care and keep organized and keep working on their benefits and other things. So that might be also explaining why there is a threefold difference in enabling services in HCH projects compared to other types of health centers. Next slide. One of the things we also wanted to take a look at is the volume of patients, and there's a national goal to increase health center patients, and that's part of the reason the Affordable Care Act had included such an investment in health centers in general. And it's also important to note that healthcare for the homeless projects, as well as other health centers in both expansion and non-expansion states, all saw increases in the number of projects. So we know that outreach and enrollment is incredibly important to achieving all of that. But what's not quite clear is that healthcare for the homeless projects in expansion states saw marginal decreases in the number of patients and in the number of patient visits. It's not quite clear from the data what might cause that, and so maybe some of our discussion can highlight that. But some of the reasons that we believe might be that people have greater patient choice, and they can go a lot of different places now that they have insurance. They might be seeking care in a non-homeless specific setting. They might have been auto-signed by managed care to another provider. So there might be a number of things going on here, and we hope to learn more about this in the future. Next slide. We know that Staffing is also key. Just as a health center operates, you've got to keep the lights on, you've got to keep staff paid. And so how is it that revenues and costs might be changing with the introduction of Medicaid, particularly in expansion states? And so one of the things we wanted to do here is look at how the revenue in particular changed, given that you'll have an increase in third-party billing with the increase in health coverage. Now, please note that because of the way the UDS data is reported, we can only look at data from the 60 Healthcare for the Homeless projects that only have a homeless grant. So those HCHs that are embedded with within other health centers are in the other health center data. But the HCH projects here really are standalone clinics that only do homeless. And one of the things that's interesting here is that even though you had a greater threshold of coverage gain, you only have half the rate, half the increase of revenue experienced by other health centers. And so that was interesting to us, and we're interested to learn more about that. And it might stand to reason, too, that in non-expansion states in the HCHs, you had marginal increases in coverage, so you're going to see marginal changes in revenue. I think that's the takeaway there. But, again, we'd like to see more of this mirror what other health centers are looking like, where they had greater increases in revenue and costs, but had smaller changes in the nature of the coverage. Next slide. So we wanted to do a deeper dive into the distribution of revenue. And so one of the things that we find here is that we've got a greater a distribution of types of funding compared to other health centers in the HCHs. Now, again, these are only 60 health centers in 2014 compared to, obviously, a far greater number, almost 1,200 health centers, other types of health centers. But take a look at how the role of grants remains important for Healthcare for the Homeless projects, particularly compared to other health centers. But even among other health centers, grants still constitute a sizable portion of the budget. So thinking about how this complements Medicaid and the sensitivity to any of these types of providers to changes in either federal or non-federal grants. Next slide. When we look at the revenue specifically in HCHs, we really are looking at some pretty stark differences. And so that's masked in the previous slide. Here's where you see some of the same disparities in the kinds of revenue that Healthcare for the Homeless projects experience based on whether in an expansion or non-expansion state, as we saw on the prior slide with regard to the disparities in healthcare coverage. And so what we're seeing in non-expansion states, grants represent nearly the entire revenue budget for those health centers. Now, again, we're not talking about many health centers. You'll see there at the bottom in 2014, this was 16 projects in non-expansion states. But you have to remember that these projects are serving some of the most vulnerable patients in their community, and so it's really important that they've got the resources to be able to meet that level of need. And in expansion state, I think the key takeaway here is it's so important to remember that Medicaid does not cover all the needed services to be able to meet this patient's population's needs. Grants are intended to fill gaps in services, and they're intended to complement Medicaid. They don't replace Medicaid. So, again, I talked about case management, outreach, and transportation as the kinds of services that are particularly important for this population. Those are services that Medicaid tends not to cover. So, again, we want to really be careful that these remain important revenue streams for all HCHs, particularly in non-expansion states. But just because you're an expansion state doesn't mean that Medicaid alone can meet all of the needs. Next slide. And then finally, we really just wanted to look ahead. So some of the things, the larger findings that we've taken away is expansion states have seen a lot greater gains in coverage and related third-party payments, which has brought a stabilizing revenue source to a lot of these community providers. When we compare that to non-expansion states, really very little has changed in that regard. And so we have to be mindful that we've got this growing disparity where we may see health outcomes in this patient population really start to also become disparate. In expansion states, those health outcomes really generate into decreased disparities with the general public. We're also seeing greater data systems in terms of more data being available, both from not just the health center setting, but in the emergency room and in the hospital and other areas of care in the community. We're able to do greater data analysis about meeting needs and how can we be doing more efficient and innovative service delivery systems. The third-party payments, again, bring a financial stability that allows these community providers to do more, like quality improvement, population health analysis, and some of these greater pieces that allow us, again, to learn more and do better with our outcomes. In non-expansion states, we're still seeing a majority of the patient population is uninsured. There's a limit to what we can do in a health center environment, so the access to that greater range of care in the community is just not present, and almost an exclusive reliance on grant funding. So thinking about how the Bureau of Primary Health Care and the health center grant that remains so critical to all health centers, particularly critical for this group of providers, and would make them very sensitive to any changes in either that grant or in the other federal or non-federal grants that are important to their revenue stream. With that, I will hand it back, but these are just the highlights of the findings that the issue brief has. As Samantha said, if you read the brief, you'll learn so much more. Thank you very much.
Great. Thanks so much, Barbara. Before we shift over to our next speakers, I did just want to mention that if you are on Twitter, we invite you to use the hashtag ACAHomeless to join the conversation we're having related to this topic. Next, I'd like to shift it over to Jackie Engel, Outreach and Enrollment Director, and Andy Patterson, Director of Homeless Services at Family Health Centers, who can talk to us about what these findings have meant for them on the ground in Louisville, Kentucky.
Thanks, Samantha. This is Andy. I direct the Healthcare for the Homeless program for Family Health Centers, which is an FQHC serving Louisville, Kentucky. Each year, we serve around 38,000 patients as a whole, and around 5,000 of those are identified as homeless and served through our Healthcare for the Homeless program. Like most Healthcare for the Homeless program, we offer a comprehensive array of services, including primary care both in a clinic and through street and shelter outreach, dental services, psychiatric and mental health services, enabling services including outreach, case management, and peer support. We have a respite program, and we also operate a permanent supportive housing program that houses around 200 individuals each year. Jackie will now talk about some of the data since Medicaid expansion and with our program.
Okay, thank you, Andy. What I'd like to talk about is how some of the data has really shifted since the ACA and the Medicaid expansion in 2013. We saw both our uninsured rate basically plummet as it went from 80% to 39% to 31%, and then we saw Medicaid coverage basically increase significantly from 2013 at 13% to 49% the next year and then 56% the following year. Interestingly, our data here at the Healthcare for the Homeless here at our family health centers here locally, their outcomes were actually at a higher rate than at the state level. So we were pretty proud of that. And then when you go to the next slide, please, then you will see that when you look at the findings, some of our findings that we have found from looking at the actual data is that when you look at family or at federally qualified health centers, they tend to serve a more at-risk patient base than the general public. But when you take it apart and you look at just the health care for the homeless, they're at an even greater risk. And so what we have found is that even though our federally qualified health center experienced at the end of 2015 an uninsured rate of 19%, it remained 31% for our healthcare for the homeless. And while the most of the folks who were enrolled and covered in the insurance were receiving Medicaid, it was higher amongst our healthcare for the homeless clients versus our general federally qualified health center clients. So less folks through our healthcare for the homeless had qualified health plans, and I know that probably doesn't seem to be a big shock to most folks, but that is what the findings state. What's interesting beyond that, though, is that when you look at what remains in the uninsured, so there's still a greater proportion of uninsured within our homeless population than in our general, also considered higher risk population. What's really interesting between those two as well is that when you look at some of the risk factors, and so one risk factor here is where folks can be disenrolled from their policies for various reasons or they'll experience gaps in coverage. And one of the statistics that I wanted to bring attention to is where you look at incarceration relief reactivations of coverage where gaps have occurred. And while you look at the data, it only lasted for about 3 months before, for the very end of 2015. So I'm sure if we looked at it now, it'd be much greater numbers. But when you look at that, you see, oh, 1% or less than 1%, you know, no big deal. But what the big deal is when you drill that data down, what you find is that amongst our homeless population, they made up 55% of all of those reactivations. So they, again, are at a higher risk of experiencing those gaps and needing to have that coverage reinstated. So to talk a little bit more about how that that coverage, though, has made a difference, I'm going to turn it back over to Andy.
Thanks, Jackie. So I just want to talk about some of the impacts that on our Healthcare for the Homeless program that came about with Medicaid expansion. So now that our patients have Medicaid, they can get specialty services that our clinic does not provide and also get quicker referrals. Prior to Medicaid expansion, some of our folks would have to wait, be put on a waiting list that could take years to get specialty services. And now they have much easier access to those and a payer source. They have access to substance abuse and mental health services that they otherwise could not get through the community mental health centers. They also have an increased choice of providers. And this has actually resulted in some folks no longer coming to our clinic. And what we have found is that folks that would typically come to our clinic for acute problems, minor problems, tend to no longer come because they can now go to have a much wider array of providers. So what's happened is it's kind of left us with a more complex level of clients because pretty much every client that our providers now see have multiple chronic problems, both primary care as well as substance abuse and mental health issues. It's increased the complexity of our system in addition to our patients. So insurance typically requires pre-authorizations and forms and, you know, a certain way to bill, and we went from having a small minority of patients for whom we had to do that for to now the majority of our folks. So it's added a level of complexity. We've mentioned that it certainly increased our revenue. It's also decreased our medication cost. Prior to Medicaid expansion, we were paying over $300,000 a year for medications for our clients. Now we're paying less than $50,000, so a significant decrease in the amount of expenses that we were having to pay for medication. And then finally, it's just increased the self-esteem and access to stabilization for our clients. Most of our patients who now have insurance never had insurance in their life prior to Medicaid expansion. So just in talking to our patients, they get excited about the fact that they now have health insurance. It's normalizing, and it normalizing to their life to have that benefit. So I'll turn it back to you, Samantha.
Great. Thanks so much. We really appreciate hearing about how our data findings have translated into your experiences out there in Kentucky. Before we shift it over to Cindy, I wanted to remind folks that you can submit questions at any time through the chat function. We will be beginning the question and answer period after we hear Cindy's remarks next. So go ahead and get those queued up if you have ones that you would like answered. And now we'll turn it over to Cindy Funkhauser, President and CEO at Sulzbacher Center in Jacksonville, Florida.
Yes, well, good afternoon, everyone, from the sunny non-expansion state of Florida. First of all, I want to say how jealous I am after listening to Jackie and Andy. So here in Florida, you know, unfortunately, without Medicaid expansion, the poorest adults in our state still have no access to affordable health coverage. Not only did they not get Medicaid, but also they don't qualify for subsidies under the Affordable Care Act. So basically, nothing has changed for them. Many of these adults are still relying on hospital emergency rooms, but are unable to pay. So this continues to cause an extreme burden on the system, but particularly our indigent hospital here in Jacksonville, who has had extreme difficulty staying afloat over the last few years. At the Sulzbacher Center, we are the largest comprehensive homeless provider in Northeast Florida. We work around three areas, income, housing, and healthcare. And all of that happens on one large campus here in downtown. In our FQHC, our 330H, we do provide access to primary care, dental, behavioral health, optical, substance abuse, HIV, primary care, and limited pediatric services, all of that on site. But a large problem for us remains specialty services. That's extremely challenging for people without coverage. We do have a great nonprofit here in Jacksonville called WeCare, and I think other cities have WeCare networks, and they do partner with hospitals and doctors who will donate specialty care, donate time for specialty care. And I actually just came from Mayo, and Mayo here in Jacksonville is one of the largest donors of that specialty care, about $1 million a year. Ways that, you know, we're leveraging our very limited resources, we do communicate and collaborate as much as possible with our community partners, such as other charity clinics, volunteers in medicine, WeCare that I mentioned. We do a lot of partnering with our local health department. We also serve as a teaching facility for medical and dental residents, interns, and students for all the regional medical schools. This increases capacity to serve our patients as well. So University of Florida, University of North Florida, all of the major colleges in the area do send patients to our dental clinics and to our primary care clinics. So that is one way that we are leveraging, which is very beneficial. As far as dental care, we are doing something really interesting. We're partnering with local hospitals. We're diverting patients with dental needs from the ER. And we have been tracking this ER diversion for about a year now. In the first 8 months of that year, we were able to save local hospitals $750,000. So that is something that's interesting and a great partnership that we have with the hospitals. Next slide, please. So, what are some of the financing issues that we're seeing in without Medicaid expansion? So without Medicaid expansion, we rely, as Barbara was already saying, we're very dependent on our HRSA grant funding, along with other federal and foundation grants. So just as a comparison, in 2014, 72% of our funding for our 330H came through our Healthcare for the Homeless grant compared to, I noticed, 54% of other HCHs. So we are heavily, heavily dependent on that grant funding here. And obviously, we're having to supplement that with fundraising and private donations, which is about 28% of the funding. And absence Medicaid funding, this is limiting the availability of services, obviously. And it also makes it difficult, and this is a huge problem for us, to recruit and retain providers. We actually have had a psychiatric position open for 2 years. We've had the funding for it. We have not been able to hire a psychiatrist for 2 years. And then you can see the chart, which basically shows you from 2013 to 2015, the uninsured rate in our clinics it's very high. We're still at 92% uninsured, and that is compared to, in the state of Florida, at HCHs, 72%. So we are 20% higher than even HCHs. And again, I think one of the reasons for that might be that we are co-located on the same campus with our shelter. So the vast, vast majority of everyone coming into our clinics are coming from the shelters in our downtown area. Next slide. What are we seeing as far as the service gaps and future priorities in our environment? Mental health is without a doubt the number one largest gap in service in our particular state. Florida is 49th out of 50 states in mental health funding, so we're at the bottom of the barrel. We have a very fractured system with a dearth of resources. I've already mentioned this, but there, and this is, I know, a nationwide problem, but particularly here in our area, there is a severe shortage of, and we have an inability to hire psychiatrists. And we actually lost the one psychiatrist that we had, was killed in Zambia. It's a very freak accident that happened on Thanksgiving Day. So right now we are without a psychiatrist at all. We're using locum tenens at this point in time. But on the plus side, new legislation was just passed in this session that just ended to expand the role of ARNPs here in Florida. We were one of the few states where nurse practitioners could not prescribe medication without being under the direct supervision of a doctor. So now that has changed, and ARNPs are going to be able to prescribe. So that will be beneficial for us moving forward because we do have ARNPs in place. Dental is our number two service gap. For us, there's little to no access for uninsured adults. There's limited financial support from private donors around the area of dental. That's not something, at least we find in our area, that donors are very interested in supporting. We did find one this past year that did support dental specifically, but that is a rarity. The lack of volunteer dentists, this is, and when I say that, I mean on an ongoing basis. We do have specific events throughout the year where we can get a lot of dentists there, you know, in one day or in one weekend, but as an ongoing issue, we have a hard time getting dentists to volunteer regularly. And then we already talked about BER diversion, which is on the plus side, is something we're tracking with the hospitals. They recognize that that we are saving them a lot of money. And we do have we probably have four of the major hospitals on our board. So we do receive a lot of support here from the hospitals. And then lastly, in the state of Florida, HIV is a huge problem. Florida leads the nation in new HIV infections. HIV rates per 100,000 people, there are three cities in the state of Florida in the top 10. Miami, number one, Jacksonville, number three, and Orlando, number eight in the nation. And unfortunately, at our state level, this is not treated as a crisis. And as a matter of fact, Department of Health, their funding at the state level has been cut over the last several years, particularly around HIV. So although we are having a crisis, it's not being recognized. And so we recently received a CDC and Department of Health grant, and we have expanded our HIV care, our primary care. We have an interdisciplinary team now at both of our clinics. So we have expanded our primary care for HIV in the last year. So that is what it looks like from the 10,000-foot level in the non-expansion state of Florida. It's pretty dire consequences here for people who are poor and uninsured.
Okay, thanks so much for sharing that perspective, Cindy. So I would invite folks now to go ahead and ask any questions you would like through the chat function. Just to sum up what we've heard so far today, I think Barbara presented the data analysis, which really showed through numbers how Healthcare for the Homeless projects in states that have expanded Medicaid have experienced large gains in coverage since the expansion took effect, and that's translated into gains in third-party revenue. And we've heard from Jackie and Andy that that's meant increases in access to care for their patients, as well as changes administratively for their operations as a center. In contrast, in the non-expansion states, things have remained pretty much the same. They continue to serve a very high uninsured population and remain heavily reliant on grant funding as the primary source of their funding. And Cindy, I think, has really touched on a lot of the challenges that means for patient care and for center operations. Again, the information from today's briefing, including a recording of the briefing, will be available on our website at kff.org. But let's go ahead and jump into some questions. Barbara, can you maybe talk a little bit about how grant funding is distributed across different projects and across the states? And would there ever be a case in which funding would be diverted from expansion to non-expansion states?
Sure. The one revenue stream for the grant is through HRSA and the Bureau of Primary Health Care and its health center grants. And those are either competitive grants where they'll release an opportunity to apply for a new access point or expanded services. There have also been times when they've done base adjustments or other across-the-board increases that have benefited everyone. So that has been a mix, and it's my understanding from discussions we've had with personnel at HRSA that they have not used a state's decision on Medicaid to sway their decisions on grants. But that might be a question that we could ask our federal counterparts for their perspectives in another setting. But also we look at other types of grants, SAMHSA block grants for mental health and addiction. There are PATH grants for outreach. There are a number of other grant sources that come from the feds that are targeted toward homeless populations for various services. Or they might be more general, where a state then can reallocate that to targeted areas. Of course, states and localities also will develop their own grants based on community needs and where state assessments have targeted opportunities. So I think that we see a wide range of things, and I'd be curious if, you know, Andy or Cindy or someone could talk a little bit about, like, where they see those opportunities being the greatest for them. I might have
Andy.
Put you on the spot. Sorry, Andy.
All right. Well, while you think about that, let's, Andy, you had mentioned in your remarks that one of the main impacts of the coverage gains for you all has been the increased access to specialty care among your patients. One of our participants has noticed that in Boston, they've seen some increased diagnoses of cancer as more patients are getting connected into specialty services. Do any of you all have similar observations or experiences related to how increased access to specialty care is maybe changing patterns of diagnoses of different conditions?
Yeah, this is Andy. Unfortunately, I can't speak to that with any data. Sorry.
It's okay. Can you maybe speak to the types of specialty care that the coverage gains have really facilitated for you all that used to be a real barrier for folks?
Well, a lot of the specialty cares are going to be around particularly things like cancer treatments. It's going to be a lot of mental health and substance abuse treatments, those types of things. Wherever you're going to need any type of a referral from a PCP, all of those things are going to, they were all impacted. This is Jackie, by the way.
And Cindy, similarly, can you speak, you mentioned to the fact that access to specialty care remains challenging without the Medicaid expansion. Can you provide some examples of the types of specialty care that folks maybe have difficulty accessing, and what does that really mean? Are there sometimes cases in which folks are just not getting care?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, when you're looking at cancer treatment in particular, you know, we may find something in our, you know, as they're here doing their primary visit, we may find a lump, we may find that sort of thing. And then, because we're, you know, we are utilizing WeCare, which is great, but sometimes people have to wait many, many months, before they can get in to seek that specialty, treatment. So, I would say, oncology definitely would be one that is a big problem. We do have, I will say this, I do want to point this out. Mayo Clinic actually comes to our clinic one night, a month, and they do special procedures clinic, they do a GI specialty clinic, they do a psychiatric clinic. So we do have another doctor that comes from Baptist Hospital. He comes one night a month, and he does a cardiology specialty clinic. So we are, you know, pulling in specialists as much as we can, but there is still, you know, a lengthy wait for people to get in and seek the treatment that they need. When we identify something in their primary care visit that needs a specialist, you know, we try to get people in as soon as possible, but it's very limited, and it can take a long time to get someone seen. So that remains a huge dilemma and a huge problem. You know, we used to say we almost don't want, you know, it's almost terrible to find that lump and to get the biopsy and then find out, in fact, that person does have cancer, and then it takes, you know, a long time in order for that person to get the treatment that they need. So it's a very dire situation.
Thanks for that, Cindy. I think another challenge you mentioned in your remark was the access to psychiatrists and behavioral health services. Cindy, you had mentioned that specifically in a non-expansion state, but I think that continues to be a challenge across states. Do any of you want to speak to any ideas or initiatives that may be underway to increase access to these types of providers for healthcare for the homeless patients?
Well, I mean, I'll just say, and this is Cindy, that I have talked, you know, we've talked to the local hospitals about this. The hospitals can't even recruit. Psychiatry, for some reason, is a specialty that new doctors are not going into at the numbers that they used to. It's one of the, from what I understand, one of the lower paid specialties. So I think with the old supply and demand, eventually, you know, psychiatrists are, the demand for them is at a very high level right now. And as we're recruiting two psychiatrists right now, because we lost one and we had funding for another. And we're really having to up the salary, in order to, you know, have anybody even looking at our positions. When you have, you know, big hospitals like Baptist, not being able to find a psychiatrist, you know, how difficult is it for a healthcare for the homeless project? It's really, it's at a crisis, level.
And, Jackie and Andy, what's the situation like for you all?
With psychiatry services, we have a full-time psychiatric nurse practitioner. And we actually contract with our community mental health center. So it's actually a CMHC employee, but she works on site for us full-time. So we've had that collaborative agreement for 10 years or so now. We have not had an issue filling that position, knock on wood. So we've not had that problem, thankfully.
Andy, while we're with you, can you talk a little bit about, so you saw increased revenues coming from your coverage gains among your patient base. Can you talk about how those revenues have helped operations at the center and what you've been able to do with them?
Well, actually, the larger community mental health, the larger agency, as I said earlier, we have seven sites, six of those serve the general population, and we're healthcare for the homeless. So the General Community Health Center was subsidizing our health care for the homeless because our budget was much larger than our revenue. So Medicaid expansion has basically allowed us to get even, basically. So we're not making a whole lot of money necessarily. We're just not losing it like we were before.
Okay, great. Barbara and others, can you speak to any examples of how Healthcare for the Homeless Centers may be working with permanent supportive housing providers and how Medicaid fits in there?
I can start. Certainly this is an area that is emerging as housing is increasingly showing health benefits. It's certainly a social determinant of health. It's obviously a issue that our clients specifically lack, and then you can see that reverberate across the system. CMS has been really proactive in issuing guidance to states that specifically gives permission for states to ask to add housing support services into their Medicaid plans. And so we're really excited to see more and more states submit 1115 waivers or 1915 waivers or different types of state plan amendments or health home models that incorporate housing-related services. Now, I'm sure everyone on CMS that's on this call will want me to say this does not cover use Medicaid dollars to pay for housing, but the kinds of services that are important to stabilize people and make that transition and keep them stable are really, I think, going to revolutionize the integration of housing and healthcare. Andy and Cindy, I know both of you are doing work in this area, so maybe you can talk a little bit more.
Well, I can talk about it from a non-expansion perspective. We have a really interesting housing first model. I know Barbara knows about this, and it's called the Chronically Homeless Offender Program, and our Jacksonville Sheriff's Office came to us a couple of years ago, and they basically said, we have 74 homeless people who are rotating through the jail 5-10 times a year for misdemeanor arrests, and these are really lifestyle crimes, trespassing, open container, that sort of thing. And it makes no sense that they're rotating through the jail. And so this was actually our first foray into a true housing first program. We're partnering with the jail, the public defender, the state attorney, the probation office, our housing authority, Lutheran Services of Florida, who has SAMHSA funding. And what we are doing is when we've identified 25 of those sort of frequent flyers, and we identified the people that were the most medically vulnerable, the top 25 of the 74 who would have died on the street the soonest. And when that person is arrested in the system, they're flagged, and they are then given an opportunity. They have a choice of either going to jail and doing their time, whatever that would be, which would at this point be extensive because they've been arrested so many times, or behind door number two, we will give them a permanent supportive housing, fully furnished apartment, low barrier. The only thing that you have to do is stay housed and not get arrested. So we are connecting those folks directly to our clinics, you know, so they have complete health care, they have housing, and we're sending in peer support specialists, supportive living coaches into their home, and we're tracking recidivism. And it has been a huge success, but that's an example of complete wraparound services for those folks that we're putting into that permanent supportive housing project. They have, you know, complete access to all of our services, and we do have a SOAR processor here, so someone that's signing people directly up for disability if they are not already signed up. So it's a very comprehensive model of wrapping all the health care, you know, the housing, everything into one program. And we're really proud of that fact that, you know, at this point, we've been doing that for about 18 months. We have 21 people in that program Some of them have been in there the full 18 months. We only lost two people out of the program the whole time. And they have complete access to all services. And some of these folks are people that have been on the street for 20 years and longer. So that is truly a partnership where, you know, we are partnering the housing and the healthcare directly. And we're able to do that because we, it's all, you know, internal within our organization. We have the services, but we are partnering also with all of the other community agencies, that I mentioned. So that's kind of an interesting model, that we're doing.
Great. Andy or Jackie, did you have anything you wanted to add?
Yeah, this is Andy. We have a program that almost, is identical to what Cindy was just saying, so I won't repeat that. We have about 200 individuals that are in permanent supportive housing with us, all voucher-based Housing First program funded by HUD and with services funded by SAMHSA. And one thing we do is our nurse practitioner, one day a week we'll do home visits to folks in our permanent supportive housing program for those folks that are especially vulnerable and not and isolating and not getting out, to try to reach out to them and provide medical services there at home. Kentucky is in the very, very early stages of doing some of those innovative housing payments, that not for housing but for services that Barbara was mentioning. So many agencies here in Louisville are working towards doing more of that. But I think having a permanent supportive housing program within a healthcare for the homeless program is really great, because that housing piece and that the healthcare piece is very easily integrated and connected.
I think another area where healthcare for the homeless projects have a lot of experience is the integration of behavioral and medical services. And we saw in the data that Barbara presented that the behavioral health and enabling services account for a much larger share of services compared to other health centers. Do any of you have some best practices or lessons learned that you can share about integrating those services? Because I know that's an area that a lot of other providers outside of the homeless community are now really interested in trying to make progress in.
Well, this is Cindy, and I just want to say that I always, when I'm taking people through on tours, and especially people that are in the healthcare field, I always like to say that the FQHC model, the Healthcare for the Homeless model that we're running, is the most comprehensive and holistic model of any model, because we have in the same building and on the same floor, we have our primary care clinic and we have our dental clinic right side by side, and right upstairs is behavioral health and, you know, an optical embedded in there as well. All of the services embedded together, sharing the same electronic health record, which is, you know, really, really important. And if someone comes into our dental clinic and, you know, we take blood pressures when people come into the dental clinic. If someone comes in there and they notice the person's blood pressure is really high, they walk them right over to primary care. If someone comes into the dental clinic, and the same with behavioral health. If someone's in behavioral health and they become very agitated or they start having any sort of health issues, then, I mean, you literally can walk the person right next door. It's so integrated. The providers are talking to each other on a regular basis, not just through electronic health records, but they're there together. They're co-located in the same facility. So just, and not just behavioral health and primary care, which I know a lot of people talk about, but we are very integrated all the way around. I mean, when does your therapist ever talk to your primary care doctor? When does your dentist ever talk to your primary care doctor? So I think FQHC generally speaking is so comprehensive. I mentioned I was at Mayo a little earlier doing a presentation, and Mayo has a very, you know, as everyone knows, a really comprehensive model. But no one has a model where all of those types of providers are co-located together, talking to each other, and providing that comprehensive care, that holistic care for the patient. So, you know, I think that whether you're an expansion state or non-expansion, it doesn't matter. We should all be very proud of that model. And I think that people that are not in FQHCs could learn a lot from the model that we use.
Jackie, Andy, any thoughts from your end?
No, it sounds like our setup is exactly the same as Cindy's. I'd say that the two main things are EHR, where everything's integrated, and co-locating, so it's easy to get folks from one department to another.
The only thing I would add would be from an outreach and enrollment perspective is the fact that you have so many open doors through the various services. And because those providers do talk to one another and we have shared departmental head meetings where that those providers interact with one another, then the referrals to outreach and enrollment obviously benefit from that. And then obviously the biggest referral sources we have besides one another is word of mouth through our patients. And so since we've been able to garner the respect of our patients for the most part, they are our number one referral source for enrollment. We've enrolled 40% of the general population of 40% of those we've enrolled have been from the general population and not our patients. So we're very proud of that fact.
Jackie and Andy, while we're with you, so I believe there are a number of potential changes afoot in Kentucky. Can you talk a little bit about what those potential changes are and how you think they might affect you and the patients you serve?
Well, a lot of that is unknown, and we will find out as things go forward. So unfortunately, I won't be able to speak a lot to that because, frankly, it's really unknown. We do know that it is the absolute goal for the state of Kentucky to go from a successful state exchange to back to transitioning into the federal healthcare.gov model. And so while no one should lose coverage as a result of that, the details are very – the devil's in the details. And so it's going to really depend on how many barriers are there and how many are perceived, how many are real, how difficult is it for people to navigate web systems, how difficult is it for people to access people who can help folks to enroll and understand very complicated questions. And just how do people access those? And when we're talking about the healthcare for the homeless population, the barriers are high. You know, they don't have phones where they can be on hold for hours. And we've heard that there are, you know, certain issues like that with healthcare.gov. You know, I don't know that firsthand. It's just what we've heard. And so, you know, we also know that when we're talking about relying on web-based systems, when folks don't have a roof over their head, they certainly don't have internet. So we are very aware of what could be and very hopeful that it will be a smooth transition, but we just simply don't know at this time.
Okay. We're coming to the close of the hour. I just want to squeeze in one question for Cindy. Is there details available on your dental diversion program and the homeless offender program that you mentioned? Are there results or details available in another place that folks can maybe access?
Not that they can access, but if anyone's interested in further information on those, they can reach me directly on my email, cindyfunkhauser@tscjax.org, tscjax.org. They can contact me, and I'm happy to answer any questions or give them any additional information.
Great. And along that note, if folks have additional questions that or want additional information that we weren't able to cover today, you can reach out to Chris Lee, our communications officer here at the Kaiser Family Foundation, and he can direct your question to the appropriate person from today's webinar and try to get it addressed. So with that, I really want to thank you so much for taking the time to participate in today's web briefing. We hope you found it informative and useful for your work. I want to again thank our speakers, Barbara DiPietro with National Healthcare for the Homeless Council, Jackie Engel and Andy Patterson with Family Health Centers in Louisville, Kentucky, and Cindy Funkhauser with Sulzbacher Center in Jacksonville, Florida. As a reminder, you will find the full report for the findings presented here today on our website at kff.org, along with the two earlier focus group reports on this topic. In the coming days, you will also be able to access a recording and transcript of today's briefing. And again, if you have follow-up questions, contact Chris Lee. Thanks again. We hope you will join us for future events.